Radioactive nuclear contamination. It doesn't just come from the bomb or even nuclear reactors. Radioactive waste taken from reactor operations can be and is recycled into a passive nuclear weapon, a radiation weapon, nukes without the blast. They do this by packing the radioactive waste, depleted uranium, into tank-fired bullets. These have the power to pierce metal, explode upon impact, and spread deadly radioactive debris over a large area. Not as blatant as a mushroom cloud explosion, but a deadly technique that proves the adage that nuclear kills two ways, fast by blast, slow by glow, that glow meaning radiation. Depleted uranium, DU, is a radiation weapon, and while it takes time to do its dirty work, it does kill. So when a genuine expert on depleted uranium weapons fills you in on what they are, how they're used, and what's wrong with them, and he tells you
that it does contaminate the environment, and that's the really long-lasting problem that we have with these weapons, is that their use in the environment just adds a pollutant that will go on for as long as probably humans habitate the planet.
Yes, to that and so much more. Well, when you hear Jack Cohen-Joppa, co-founder of the nuclear resistor, now in its 44th year, goes into detail about what DU weapons are, what they aren't, and how they are being used, you can't avoid seeing how you and I and everyone else is truly stuck in that dirty, awful, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we learn about depleted uranium weapons, DU weapons, what they are, what they can do, where they are and are not being used in today's world war zones. We talk with Jack Cohen-Joppa, one of the founders of the Nuclear Resistor. It is an organization and a newsletter that networks the anti-nuclear and anti-war resistance movement while acting as a clearinghouse for information about contemporary nonviolent resistance to war and the nuclear threat. This is information you really are not going to get from mainstream media. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, the monthly ICAN update, direct from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons in Geneva, Switzerland, with Alistair Burnett. And we will have more honest nuclear information than anyone will be talking about on next week's presidential candidate debates. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, September 3rd, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out this week with Linda Pence Gunter and this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
The trouble with nuclear technology of any kind, really, is that it depends on sensible and even intelligent decisions being made by supremely fallible human beings. The consequences of even a simple mistake are, as we have already seen with Chernobyl, catastrophic. To add to our worries, nuclear technology also relies on other seemingly elusive human traits, beginning with sanity, but also something more fundamental, and something that ought to be, but isn't, fundamentally human, empathy. That means not wanting to do anything to other people you wouldn't want to endure yourself. But of course, we see humans doing these things every day, whether at the macro individual level or on a geopolitical scale. It was that global bullying, that lust for power and dominance that got us into the nuclear age to begin with, delivering both nuclear weapons and nuclear energy technology. And so now we are perpetually on the precipice of disaster, clinging on by our fingernails and hoping to dodge yet another nuclear bullet. Currently, such a looming disaster is looking like a distinct possibility in Russia, as that country's massive Kursk nuclear power plant is the latest such facility to find itself literally in the line of fire as Ukrainian troops make their incursion there in response to Russia's ongoing war in their country. Kursk is a 6-reactor site, one of the largest nuclear power plants in Russia, just as Zaporizhia, the 6-reactor site also embroiled in the war, is Ukraine's and Europe's biggest nuclear facility. But unlike Zaporizhia, Kursk is the old-style reactor design, the RBMK, like Chernobyl, with no secondary containment. Also, unlike Zaporizhia, where all 6 reactors are fully shut down, making a meltdown less likely but not impossible, 2 of Kursk's reactors are still running. And the Russians have already told the International Atomic Energy Agency that they found the remains of a drone just over 300 feet away from the Kursk nuclear plant. IAEA Chief Rafael Grossi duly went off to visit the site to remind whoever is listening from either side that having a war around nuclear power plants is frightfully inconvenient when your agency is busy telling the world how safe the technology is and how badly we need more of it. However, like a helpless preschool teacher with naughty toddlers, Grossi's only recourse appears to be to tell them both repeatedly to stop. But since he can't exactly take away their candy, and in fact has no "or else" he can implement, they simply ignore him. That leaves it up to the rest of us to raise our voices and demand not only an end to this futile and cruel war, but an end to the use of nuclear power technology as well. Most of us do still have empathy for each other, no matter how far away those lives we see extinguished each night on the news may be. We don't want another Chernobyl for Ukrainians, for Russians, or for anyone. And since we can't rely on the squabblers in the sandlot to play nicely, this is one toy we have to take away. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
Lots of outside reports this week. Here is the ICANN update with Alistair Burnett, head of media for ICANN, the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons.
Hi, this is Alistair Burnett at ICANN in Geneva, and here's our monthly roundup of news from the campaign for August. In late July and early August, the members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty met in Geneva for the second meeting to prepare for the next review conference of the treaty that'll be in 2026. The meeting ended without an agreed outcome, which is another blow to the NPT process. ICANN delivered a statement to the meeting criticising the practice of nuclear-armed states placing their weapons in non-nuclear weapon states. The US has nuclear weapons in 5 NATO countries, Belgium, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands and Turkey, and Russia has them in Belarus. This so-called nuclear sharing increases the risk of nuclear conflict and is shrouded in secrecy. It is deeply hypocritical and is also controversial in the eyes of many NPT members. At the end of August, Kazakhstan, one of the leading countries in the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, hosted a series of meetings which ICANN participated in. TPNW members gathered to discuss what they can learn from the treaties that have established nuclear weapons-free zones in Africa, Central Asia, Latin America, Southeast Asia, and the South Pacific. Following that, on the International Day Against Nuclear Tests, August 29th, there was a meeting of survivors of nuclear tests from all over the world to exchange knowledge and experience and to build solidarity. There was also a youth forum, including survivors, for younger anti-nuclear campaigners to discuss and learn about the lingering harm from nuclear testing. In the week of the 79th anniversary of the US atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, ICANN released a new report on the disproportionate impact of nuclear weapons on children. Much of our knowledge and understanding of this comes from what happened to the children in those two cities. Tens of thousands were killed, but many survived only to die in the days, weeks, months, and years ahead. The author of the report was ICANN's treaty coordinator, Tim Wright. On the line to Melbourne in Australia, where he's based, I asked him what was the inspiration for the report.
If we look at the conflicts in the world today, we can see that a great many of the victims are children, and that's deeply concerning to people all around the world. And so we wanted to look at what nuclear weapons do to children specifically, and the disproportionate harm that they inflict on children based on the experiences of children in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945, as well as based on the experiences of children living in nuclear test sites around the world. And we have shared their stories through this report. We've looked at scientific research based on the harm done to them, really in the hope that this will motivate governments to work towards the total elimination of these weapons so that there are no more victims.
Why is it then that children are disproportionately vulnerable to the impact or the effects of nuclear weapons?
Well, there are many reasons. The main reason, though, is that children are particularly vulnerable to the effects of ionizing radiation. So they're much more likely to die from acute radiation sickness in the days and weeks after a nuclear attack, but they're also much more likely to die years or decades later as a result of the delayed effects of radiation from diseases such as leukemia, solid cancers, and so on. But it's also the fact that children are more likely to die from burn injuries and blast injuries as a result of their smaller bodies, the fact that their skin burns more deeply, and they're less likely to be able to take steps in the aftermath of a nuclear attack that would increase their chances of survival.
International law is meant to protect children in conflict. And for example, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child has pretty much been signed up to by everyone. And yet international law is not being observed, as we can see. So what can be done to make countries obey international law, honour the commitments that they've signed up to?
There are certainly several countries that are violating international law every day, committing very serious war crimes, failing in their duty to protect children in particular. But most countries in the world are honouring their commitments, and we need them to speak up and speak out against these violations that are occurring, and also to insist on nuclear disarmament as an action that countries must take in order to safeguard children against harm.
That was Tim Wright, author of the report The Impact of Nuclear Weapons on Children, which you can find on our website at www.icanw.org/children, or you could just put ICANW Children Report into your search engine. This is Alistair Burnett, ending ICANN's News Roundup for August.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, hey, I have a birthday coming up on Sunday, September 29th. And it's one of those landmark cornerstone ones that leads a person to look in a mirror and think, how did that happen? I'll be celebrating on the day with friends, sharing storytelling, anecdotes about me encouraged, live music, and a splurge of sugar. I have a lot to celebrate. At a time of life when so many people, including some of my closest friends, are on a downhill path away from life at the cutting edge of involvement, I find myself ramped up, energized, and chomping at the bit to do more. More fighting back against nuclear, more nuclear hot seat, more involvement with the help of people like you. So I have a three-part ask to help me with this celebration. First, if you haven't yet done so, sign up to get Nuclear Hot Seat via email every week. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big yellow box you can't miss. Fill it in with your first name and email address, and you will get the show delivered hot off the mic every week. It will also help me move up in the Google search algorithms. Secondly, I have a book, Nuclear Memoir, available on Amazon. Yes, I glow in the dark. 1 mile from 3 Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat. The royalties from sales are part of what keeps me going financially. So if you haven't read the book, consider purchasing a copy. Or maybe, in honor of my birthday, you'd be willing to make a donation in the spirit of the day. Say, $75? Oops. I said it. Yep, 75. Time flies when you talk truth to power. Anything you donate is tax deductible because Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send your donation directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate right now. Help me celebrate my birthday and whatever you can do Thanks for being part of this fight against nuclear. Now, here's this week's featured interview. There has been a lot of reference made to depleted uranium weapons, DU as they're referred to, in connection with the current multiple war zones in the world. But what are they? Why are they so deadly? Who makes them? Who's got them? And most importantly, who has been using them? To find out, I spoke with Jack Cohen-Joppa. Since 1980, Jack and Felice Cohen-Joppa have been co-coordinators of the Nuclear Resistor and co-editors of the newsletter, The Nuclear Resistor. They are dedicated to working with the anti-nuclear and anti-war resistance movements while acting as a clearinghouse for information about contemporary nonviolent resistance to war and the nuclear threat. Their emphasis is on support for the women and men jailed for these actions. For more than 44 years, they have covered reports on nuclear and anti-war arrests while encouraging support for more than 1,000 imprisoned activists. Their stated belief is that in any significant movement for social change, many committed individuals are imprisoned. Behind bars, they are physically isolated from their supporters, and their own resistance activity is limited. Broader awareness of their actions and support for the imprisoned activists are essential to the movement for a peaceful, nuclear-free future. We'll have more on that and how you can help after the interview. I spoke with Jack Cohen-Joppa on August 30th, 2024. Jack Cohen-Joppa, thank you so much for joining us on Nuclear Hot Seat this week.
Well, thanks for the invitation, Libby. I'm really pleased to be with you. I've learned a lot listening to your program.
First, a little bit of background. You've been working on nuclear issues for many decades at this point. What got you started in doing this work?
Well, I grew up in Colorado in suburban Denver, downwind from the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant. And by the time I got to college in the mid-70s at Boulder, I was fully aware of that was a nuclear weapons plant south of Boulder. And when I read in 1977 about plans to organize a demonstration at the Rocky Flats plant in conjunction with nationwide mobilization in the spring of 78, I signed on. I said, I want to be a part of that. And it kind of morphed into a year-long nonviolent occupation of the railroad tracks that served the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant. And that was an organization called the Rocky Flats Truth Force. And I have on my Rocky Flats track team t-shirt, a reissue of the track team t-shirt, because we stopped the shipments of materials in and nuclear waste out. And it led to a public trial in Jefferson County Court. And I was one of like 10 representative defendants in that trial. And along the way, I became aware of friends who were in jail. And in fact, visited a couple of people, you know, right off the bat who were in jail in Colorado for the protests at Rocky Flats. I had already been corresponding with prisoners as part of my education about the world and realized that there was a movement that was growing here and there would be people in prison. Because in any significant movement for social change in the United States, we've seen that, the committed people end up in jail for one reason or another. The struggle for women's suffrage, the labor struggles, struggles against the war and for civil rights and against segregation, all of these have resulted in social movements that people end up going to jail in. And so supporting the people in jail seemed like an important niche to fill within this growing anti-nuclear weapons and anti-nuclear power movement. And so that's where my wife and I got involved in 1980 in starting a project that soon became known as the Nuclear Resistor, publishing a newsletter that since 1980 has chronicled probably over 100,000 anti-nuclear and anti-war arrests, predominantly in the United States, but also in many, many countries around the world. And where possible, we publish the addresses of the women and men who are currently serving time or being held, you know, pending trial for those sorts of actions, and encourage people to drop them a note of support in the mail, because that's just kind of bottom line work to support the people who are really committed in the movement and not lose their commitment and give them a voice on the outside through the work of the Nuclear Resistor. That's sort of the background where I got involved in anti-nuclear activity long ago now.
Ancient history, at least several generations ago.
Yeah, I mean, we raised our kids and now we're, you know, now we're of quote unquote retirement age, but we're not retiring because there's a lot of work to be done.
You've been working most recently on issues about depleted uranium weapons. Explain to the listeners what DU weapons, as they're referred to, are, what they do, and what makes them so deadly.
Well, depleted uranium is a byproduct of the nuclear industry. Uranium ore must be enriched to separate out the isotope 235 that can be used to make nuclear fuel or nuclear weapons because it's fissionable from the heavier isotope uranium-238 that makes up the vast majority of uranium, natural uranium ore. So they have a whole lot of depleted or uranium-238 in the original ore, and they winnow out the most potent stuff, the uranium-235 for nuclear fuel and weapons in a higher grade than it exists in natural uranium. And so they have a whole lot of this uranium-238 left over. And among the uses that's been formed for this depleted uranium is for armor-piercing ammunition, for aircraft counterweights, because it has a very high density, so it only takes a smaller space in order to give something the same mass. So if you need a counterweight in an aircraft to balance the other things, but you don't have so much space, they might use depleted uranium, and they did for a long time in even commercial 747s. But the weapons use is now for principally penetrating weapons. And these are bullets, basically, made out of a core of purified depleted uranium that is slightly alloyed with another material just to make it a little bit easier to handle when they do the production. And they make these little, long, thin, penetrating rods of depleted uranium that are then, they give them a sharp tip, they give them little fins on the back to stabilize them, and they shoot them out of tanks, like the Abrams tanks that the United States makes. And they also fire them out of aircraft, like the A-10 Warthog or the Apache helicopter. And then they also fire them from smaller caliber armored vehicles like the Bradley fighting vehicle, which fires a penetrator that's a 20 millimeter diameter penetrator. So these thin rods of uranium with a sharpened end are fired at armor at a very high speed, and distinct from, say, steel or hardened steel or tungsten, the nature of the uranium projectile as it pierces the armor, say, of a tank, is that it self-sharpens. Instead of mushrooming out like a lot of bullets do when they hit a target, the depleted uranium projectile kind of melts its way through as the outside edges peel away from that long, thin rod that's going very, very fast. So between the speed and the impact velocity on that narrow diameter, it can punch its way through, almost melting its way through the tank armor in just the flash of a second. And when it gets inside the tank, it catches fire because uranium is pyrophoric. When exposed to air in the right conditions, exposed to oxygen, it can ignite into a fire. And so that's what happens. It is in many ways a superior armor-piercing ammunition, but it's also more difficult to manufacture. And improvements in tungsten alloys have made tungsten now almost a preferable element for making armor-penetrating weapons. But there's still a lot of depleted uranium weapons in global inventories. This is the use of uranium penetrating as penetrating warheads. Now, there is a confounding use that has gotten a lot of commentators confused in a unique application among American weapons. Depleted uranium is also used to harden the shroud that goes around a large warhead, a large explosive bomb gets dropped from an airplane or fired as part of a missile, a cruise missile or something. These large warheads, they have a shroud that's hardened so that they might be able to penetrate into the earth or into a concrete bunker. Now, this is different from your uranium penetrator that's a thin rod going very fast. This is a large trash can shaped with a point on the end that is hard and holds a bomb inside of it. And because it's so hard, it can kind of burrow its way into the earth. And that's just kinetic energy. There's formulations for, you know, how dense the metal is and the shape and all that and how deep it can penetrate. They make those out of tungsten and steel. However, if you look at the patents for that kind of a weapon, depleted uranium is mentioned as one of many materials that would fulfill the function of the patent, the unique patentable design of, say, these warhead shrouds. So it's been confusing for a lot of commentators that they understand that, well, yeah, it's mentioned in a patent, but a patent is different from a product. And these are not the weapons that the United States has been making for bunker busting, for using bombs to burrow into, say, underground bunkers or tunnels and destroy them. There's other means to do that. Depleted uranium is not necessary because they acknowledge that it does contaminate the environment. And that's the really long-lasting problem that we have with these weapons, is that their use in the environment just adds a pollutant that will go on for as long as probably humans habitate the planet. Concentrated in that area in the form of oxides of uranium, because it dispersed, you know, when it hit its target, when things burned, when it was exposed to the elements, and it just oxidizes and sloughs away into the environment. But it's still lots of little tiny particles of uranium that, if they get inside a body, they can wreak havoc with health. Now, it's true that uranium-238, which is the depleted uranium, it primarily emits alpha radiation, which is high energy but low mass radiation. And so a piece of paper can stop alpha radiation because it's so low mass. However, inside your body, what stops it are the first two or three or four cells it comes in contact with. And because it is so high energy, it rips up those cells and perhaps their genetic material as well. And that is the problem that uranium munitions pose in the long run, is that we've increased the concentration of uranium in that immediate environment and made it available for uptake by humans and animals and plants, where it can do the most damage internally.
We know that DU weapons were used in the war in Iraq, first in 1990 and then in 2003, most notably in and around Fallujah. What do we know about the ongoing health impact to the people in that area from the use of DU weapons?
Not as much as we should know, because all research in Iraq that could have looked at the impact of these weapons when soon after they were first used through the 90s, after the largest use was in 1991, and then, you know, again, about half as much again was used in 2003. But there was no health epidemiology done in Iraq at that time that can stand up to, you know, the standards of modern epidemiology, because there was war and sanctions going on that were depriving a whole lot of the Iraqi population of the means to take, you know, to look after their own livelihoods, let alone, you know, be concerned about health studies about the impact of the war in 1991. So number one, there's not enough information about it. How much was used in Fallujah? I don't know. I think that's up for debate, but it certainly was widely used, over 300 tons in 1991 and upwards of 175 tons again in 2003. The vast majority of all this was fired from the A-10 aircraft.
This is an American plane.
This is the American A-10, known affectionately as the Warthog, because it's a rather ugly looking airplane. And I've watched them fly over my house here in Tucson for the last 37 years because we live very close to the flight path. And Davis-Monthan Air Force Base in Tucson is the principal training base for A-10 pilots. And so almost all the A-10 pilots, as I understand, have at one time or another cycled through Tucson and made use of the flying ranges that are here in the Arizona desert and up in Nevada. Knowing that that was going on in my neighborhood, basically, that this was the principal mission of Davis-Monthan Air Force Base at the time, was these A-10s. And then they're still flying, just not as many now. That's why I got involved. I was an anti-nuclear activist. Here it is flying over my head. George Bush is telling us that Iraq has nuclear weapons or is developing nuclear weapons, but we were actually the combatant in that war that introduced radiation weapons to that part of the world. We poisoned the cradle of civilization in 1991. With massive use of depleted uranium. And a lot of that was along the highway of death, they called it, between Kuwait and Baghdad along the Euphrates River. There, is where the A-10 aircraft, once they disabled a few vehicles that were trying to flee Kuwait, then all the vehicles trying to flee Kuwait were backed up on that highway. And the A-10 pilots talked about it like shooting fish in the barrel. Thousands of vehicles were destroyed in fires triggered by this uranium ammunition. So no health studies have been done about the area around there. Studies that have been done have certainly shown uranium contamination in people, in plants, in the soil. But to characterize it and try to understand the depth, the epidemiology has been impossible to do.
That's standard with any nuclear anything, certainly from the United States, that there's no follow-up. There's no wanting to know what happened, because if the facts exist and can be accessed and are reliable, people would be horrified and policy would have to change from the pressure. The thing about Fallujah that I can remember hearing going way back is that women, young women in that area, were warned not to have children. Do we have verification for that?
I've seen those reports too. I don't know how to verify it. It kind of makes sense when I hear the anecdotal information from, you know, Iraqi mothers at that time. And I've talked to people who talked to Iraqi mothers in the hospitals because they were over there visiting during the time of the sanctions. And I mean, there was, I think, a sentiment that what are we doing if we bring our children into this world? And after they've seen some of the impact of weapons. And I think it's also fair to say that in addition to the radiation, uranium is chemically toxic. And a lot of experts believe that the chemical toxicity of uranium, period, is probably at least as much of concern as the radiation from, say, depleted uranium. I'm not talking about other higher sources of uranium, like enriched uranium that has different characteristics, but the depleted uranium, the radiation is bad, you know, when it's inside of you, but the chemical toxicity is probably just as much. And by the time you have a symbiotic relationship between chemical toxicity and radiation, there gets into a whole field that is we've certainly only begun to understand, is how these multiple toxins that are in the battlefield impact on the surviving population and on, say, aid workers who go in to assist after a conflict is over. And that's what we'll talk about maybe with Ukraine too.
You've been working on two reports with the International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons, referred to as ICBUW. And this has been specifically on DU weapons use, the war in Ukraine and the other in Israel. What sparked these reports and why are they being put together now?
The ICBU, the International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons, when Russia first invaded Ukraine in February of 22, ICBU posted a statement of concern because it was well known that Russia has tanks in their inventory and tank ammunition in their inventory made of depleted uranium. I mean, the tanks that can fire it and the tanks that have it. Because when we look at understanding weapons that can be used in a certain war, you have to look at the kind of targets that they're going after and the kind of weapons that they have to go after those targets. So in Russia, coming into Ukraine with tanks, we knew they came in there with tanks, and that we knew that Russia has depleted uranium ammunition that could fit on those tanks. So ICBU issued a statement of concern, and it is something that we need to be aware of, the world community needs to be aware of as we witness this war, is these weapons could well be used because we're talking tank battles. Fast forward then to a certain point in time, I believe in early 2023, the United States and Great Britain separately or together, you know, whatever, both agreed to send tanks that they make that fire depleted uranium rounds and the depleted uranium rounds to go with them. They would promise to supply them to Ukraine. Those weapons were delivered last fall and from all indications have been in battle in Ukraine. But there's been no specific acknowledgement by Russia that they will not or have not used their depleted uranium rounds. And the United States and Britain have been forthright that they have them there, and Ukraine says, yeah, we're planning to use them. So now the question for the International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons is, what can we do to mitigate the impact of this use of uranium weapons in this war? Because at some point, the war will come to an end. And at some point, populations will return to ravaged areas, and aid workers will come in to help clean up. How are they going to be able to identify where the depleted uranium was used? Well, we could ask Ukraine, we could ask Russia, the United States has a history of not discussing how much or where they've used depleted uranium. So that information had to come out from FOIA requests and deep dives into the documentation that was available, you know, in the 91 and the 2003 wars to talk about how much was used. We don't expect that information to be forthcoming. So the coalition has launched a Ukraine project to try to solicit information that we can work on verifying to establish where combat occurred and depleted uranium was used, so that we can provide that information. If no one else will, we can try to begin providing that information in the whole context of cleaning up after this war.
How do you go about verifying something that's happening on the other side of the world and is cloaked in so many layers of security?
That's our challenge. I mean, that's clearly our challenge. And, you know, ICBU has volunteers in Europe who have been reaching out to Ukrainian colleagues as well, and NGOs and such. And there is a hesitance on the part of Ukrainian NGOs to dive into it because they know that their forces are also definitely using the uranium weapons. So they don't want to appear as critical of their own government while they're trying to do environmental work in Ukraine. So it's a challenge on that end. And then on the Russian side, the challenges are self-evident. They don't talk about the weapons they use, but it's a good propaganda point to say that, well, the United States and Ukraine and Great Britain are poisoning Ukraine with uranium weapons. Well, but Russia has them too. And so ICBU's position has been not to take sides, but to say all nations that have uranium weapons are reminded that the United Nations has condemned their use and charged nations with the responsibility of helping to clean up after they've been used. Multiple General Assembly resolutions have put that into the international books.
Is there any awareness in Ukrainian government, in the military, in the country, that by using these weapons, they might be fighting off Russia, but they are also contaminating their own country in a way that cannot be removed?
I haven't seen any of that. We've not seen any evidence of that. It's just, you know, it's kind of a black box. And so what we've done is we've looked at the weapons and the platforms that are there. Of media concern now is one that the United States has not even acknowledged that it has supplied this particular type of ammunition, but the Bradley fighting vehicle, it's supposed to be able to transport, you know, like half a dozen troops or something in an armored vehicle, and it has smaller guns than a tank has on it. It's got a 20 or 25 millimeter gun that fires a depleted uranium round, and it also fires a regular machine gun bullet. Ukraine probably has both ammunition. It's not clear whether they've been supplied with the depleted uranium armor-piercing ammunition or they've only been supplied with the high-explosive ammunition that's fired out of the Bradley fighting vehicle gun. So that's an unknown, but there's been discussion among the open-source intelligence networks. These are like military buffs who follow now with all the social media videos that we have and drone videos of tank engagements in Ukraine and everything else. Analysts who look at that and try to figure out, well, where is this battle happening? Can we verify that through geospatial information? Can we understand from looking at the tanks and looking at the video imagery of the battle going on, can we deduce that that's uranium ammunition being used? Some commentators think that there are signs that may be indicative, but certainly not determinative. So in the end, we need to know where these battles took place along the front lines and be able to go in post-war with an educated evaluating team to take samples and look at the damaged tanks and say, because it, like I was describing earlier, the impact of a depleted uranium round on tank armor is rather distinctive compared to other rounds that would be fired at a tank that are not made of depleted uranium. So when you look at it, and then you can find oftentimes on the battlefield, and they found this in Iraq quite a bit, litter of the depleted uranium rounds that either didn't hit their target or broke up when they hit the target. And there's large chunks of these rods of uranium that are now covered with kind of a distinctive oxides, black and yellow oxides of uranium. How to handle those is an important skill for returning civilians and aid workers and military personnel cleaning up after the war, that sort of thing. So that's the goal of the Ukraine project, is to try to raise awareness of this with a view towards the end of the war, because that's when, like, the chickens come home to roost, we would say. That's when we'll have the chance to actually verify some of this information.
The report you speak of, is it available, and if so, how?
Yeah, it is available on the ICBU website. ICBUW.EU is the ICBU website. It's the ICBU update on DU in Ukraine, and it was posted just a few days ago. And it should be at the top of the English homepage here. Let's see. Yeah, it's one of the you know, the panels at the top of the webpage that has a couple of recent, you know, additions to it, and you'll see it right there. ICBU update on DU in Ukraine.
Has there been any media interest in this? Has anyone responded to it, or have you done any distribution of it yet?
We've only started to do some distribution. There has been some interest, not a lot, because there's bigger stories of the war. Everybody knows war is bad. This is just one more bad thing about war. So it doesn't, you know, rise to the top as a leading story about the war at this point. Where it'll go, I don't know. I mean, if we could verify that indeed Bradley fighting vehicles were using depleted uranium ammunition based on visual confirmation of that ammunition in a Ukrainian Bradley fighting vehicle, or testimony of military officials who would have reason to know in the United States or in Ukraine, their affirmation of that. That would be the kind of thing I'd be looking for right now to verify that, say, Bradley fighting vehicles are firing depleted uranium. That might be news, because they haven't mentioned that. It's part of the black box about depleted uranium weapons use. There's a few different platforms that could use it, don't necessarily do. And we're not going to talk about it because there's a war going on.
Where else in the world right now are issues of depleted uranium weapons showing up?
Well, that's certainly the only conflict where it's happening, because typically you're talking about tank battles. You're going to be looking at situations where there's armor that needs to be destroyed, and this is the weapon of choice for handling armor. These weapons were developed for tank battles in Europe, and the A-10 aircraft was developed to go up in the sky and come down and swoop in low and fire these bullets at tanks on the ground. So that's what you're first going to suspect, is if there's weapons involved, that there would be a military, quote-unquote, necessity to use depleted uranium to go after.
Palestine's permanent representative to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Saleh Abdel Shafiz, has expressed suspicion that DU weapons have been used by Israeli military and is warranted given the platforms and weapons available. What has ICBUW done with this information? What have been its observations and any conclusions that might have come up so far?
Well, we've been paying attention to the issue of Israel's use of depleted uranium for nearly the entire time the ICBU has been around, because there have been allegations going back to 2006 of Israel using uranium weapons when it attacked Lebanon. Then further allegations of novel, different, you know, mystery weapons being used in the assault on Gaza in 2009 after Operation Cast Lead. So because Israel does have uranium ordnance and the platforms that could fire it, it's a fair question, because they've been using tanks in Gaza. Hamas doesn't have tanks. So whether they would need to use that tank ammo is an open question. And we don't have direct evidence that they've used that ammunition in Gaza. Again, how do you do proper scientific investigation in Gaza right now? It's an even more impossible situation than we had in Iraq in the 1990s to try to verify what's going on with the weapons that are being used. So ICBU acknowledges that the suspicion is warranted, and it is the job of the International Atomic Energy Agency to be monitoring whether that is a possibility. But we've seen no conclusive evidence to support that claim. And part of the claim has gone back to this issue of bunker-busting weapons. And one particular bomb that comes up is the 2,000-pound BLU-109, which is an earth-penetrating, large, you know, 2,000-pound warhead that the United States produces. And allegations have been made, as I talked about earlier, that these kind of weapons somehow benefit from the use of uranium. And as I've tried to talk to the people who have advanced this suspicion, I've realized that these are really just speculations. They've looked at the patent and they say, oh, uranium has this unique pyrophoric ability. It just helps it burrow into the earth. Well, the bomb is a lot larger diameter. It's going a lot slower. It doesn't have the same impact velocity. It doesn't behave the same. It's a different kettle of fish with the uranium. There's no need, military necessity, or advantage to using these depleted uranium warheads on a penetrating conventional bomb. They've got other materials. There's no licenses for the producers of depleted uranium weapons, as we see for the ammo that exists, the ammo that's for the tanks and the aircraft and the Bradley fighting vehicles. There's licenses that are publicly available to the companies that handle that depleted uranium that they get from the U.S. government, because it's a hazardous material. They have to have a license. It comes from the government. There are production contracts that talk about producing this kind of weapon, this many of them, by this date. They exist for these other weapons. No one's ever shown me one for a bunker buster bomb that uses uranium. No one's ever released any information about being trained to handle those bombs differently from others. The uranium ammunition in the tanks and the aircraft is handled differently. It has a different protocol than the regular non-radioactive ammunition. None of this documentation exists to support the claim that there is either bunker busters that the U.S. makes with depleted uranium, or for that matter, anyone else. So we've been critical, and we don't see that there's any evidence. And at this point, we kind of find that continuing to talk about, oh, but it could be, is really distracting from the task at hand, which is to address the actual use, to show that it's been used, because we're only going to get support from the world community for this sort of an outrage if we have the goods, if we got the evidence, if we have the receipts. None of that exists in the case of these allegations of uranium use in Gaza. The other sort of anomalous situation is that there have been a number of surveys that have tried to look at soil and other evidence around the area for uranium contamination. And some have indicated that there might be some odd uranium contamination of isotope ratios that don't seem to match natural uranium. None of this research has been replicated. And the research that I've read has not ruled out the most obvious and adjacent source of possible uranium contamination in Gaza, which would be leaks from Israel's nuclear weapons facility at Dimona. We don't know what goes on at Dimona. It's almost all underground, literally. But they have waste, and it has leaked, and there is evidence that it has leaked, and we don't know where it all went. So unless a study can both be replicated in Gaza and say, yeah, these everywhere we're looking, you know, this type of sampling, it's happening. We've got these unusual radioisotope signatures. They have to rule out Dimona as a source first. And these sorts of isotopic studies can be done. Michael Ketterer has spoken on your program a number of times about what can and cannot be done looking at environmental samples and evaluating isotopic signatures of the various radioactive elements that you find. So there's a lot of unknowns about Gaza. The destruction there far exceeds what I can imagine, and the percentage of the problem that uranium weapons are there, honestly, is pretty small in my estimation when I look at all the other problems, when I look at all the other toxins just from regular conventional explosives leave a hazardous toxic residue in the environment.
Does ICBU have, or are they planning on having, a report about Israel and Gaza that addresses these issues?
We are going to be publishing here in a few days, and you should be able to put it up by the time you publish this program, addressing the allegations of depleted uranium use in Gaza and breaking it down where we come out standing, which is these weapons should never be allowed on the battlefield. And we don't have enough evidence to say that Israel has been using them in Gaza.
We will, of course, link to these reports as they become available so that we have them on the website for this episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. What's next in terms of the research, or is it simply ongoing and you will be reporting on it as you find things out?
It is ongoing because, I mean, we're also still just evaluating how best to assemble this information for sharing as it comes in. And we're still asking for this community of people who are concerned about cleaning up after a war for their help in identifying where it might have been used so that we can begin to put that on a spreadsheet, a map, whatever, and say, these are our areas of concern that we can identify. Here's the documentation, why we believe they need to be checked out. That's our goal in the long run. But up to now, it's been really difficult because there's not too many reporters on the front lines. You know, when you think about Vietnam and compare the press coverage that we had in Vietnam, when you even think about Afghanistan and the press coverage, even though they were embedded or in bed with the military, there was at least a civilian, quasi-civilian voice telling us what might be happening in a battle. And in Ukraine, we have social media, and it's a vast universe of social media. And so I've been trying on my limited understanding of how to reach out to people who are involved in worlds that I am not monitoring military activities to say, here's our project. You have expertise. We have our expertise. We need to work together to help people down the road. And so, yes, there will be future reports and commentary from ICBU as we go forward.
And of course, we'll want to hear all of it here on Nuclear Hot Seat. A personal question. You are arguably dealing with the cutting edge, horrific nuclear news that is happening in the world today with the military, with the wars, with things that are probably beyond most people's comprehension. How do you keep your head on straight? I mean, how do you deal with the pressure and the awfulness of some of the things you are learning?
I'm fortunate to have come from a loving family, and I have a loving family. So number one, then beyond that, sort of the family of choice, the community that, you know, I've, I guess, cultivated or cherished and held close, because it is a lot of other people who recognize that we're in a pickle as a species. And how are we going to do that? So that plus a little bit of boneheadedness. And also, I recognize after the nuclear resistor got started in the 80s, and, you know, it was pretty thick of things at that time, I identified that I was dealing with a lot of anger at having my future ripped off, because I was born in 56. And so I grew up and I learned about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, as I don't know that students necessarily do today. I saw that, but I also saw the power of nonviolent direct action, watching the civil rights movement and watching the struggle against the war in Vietnam. And I thought, well, here is humane behavior and response to these horrors. That's the side that I want to be on. You know, like my future got ripped off, I would have done other things maybe with my life than be an anti-nuclear activist. But that's a way of dealing with my anger that, you know, this is the world that I was born into. I have to deal with this threat of omnicide. So those are the things that keep me going, that and maybe gardening and hiking.
I can relate to both of those latter ones. Where can people access the nuclear resistor and sign up to be on your distribution list?
You could go to nukeresistor.org or nuclearresistor.org. And that's resistor with an E-R at the end. Resistor with an O-R is an electrical component. nuclearresistor.org. And there you'll see our website, and there's a link to the current issue of our newsletter and to a lot of the back issues of the newsletter, because the oldest back issues, we're still working on getting them available as word searchable documents.
Jack Cohen-Joppa, this has been a powerful, eye-opening, brilliant, and certainly upsetting interview to hear, because this is information we're not getting from any place else. So my deepest gratitude to you and your confederates, as it were, at ICBUW. And my thanks for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
That was Jack Cohen-Joppa, co-coordinator of the group and co-editor of the newsletter, The Nuclear Resistor. We'll have a link up to the website and direct connection to the two reports he mentioned, the ones on Ukraine-Russia and on Israel-Gaza, on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 689. Know that the Nuclear Resister provides the names and jail addresses of currently imprisoned anti-nuclear and anti-war activists. People are encouraged to provide active support by writing letters to those behind bars, and in other ways requested by the prisoners. Our congratulations to Heidi Huttner, teacher extraordinaire and filmmaker extraordinaire, whose film, Radioactive, you can have it to rent or purchase through Amazon. If you happen to be in Scotland on September 12th in Edinburgh, there is a free event that explores the links between Scottish identity. It will focus on the contribution of the late John Ainslie, nuclear weapons expert and campaigner, to the anti-nuclear movement and celebrate the return of his archive to Scotland. Networking. The tickets are free, but you have to sign up for it. I will have that link on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. What a lot. And our thanks to climate and energy scientist Mark Z. Jacobson, who reports that based on new U.S. energy, a U.S. state has supplied over 100% of its annual average electricity demand between July 1st of 2023, and which of our 50 states is so richly endowed with genuinely renewable energy? South Dakota. Yes, South Dakota produced the equivalent of 100.6% of its electricity demand from wind, water, and solar in the year July 1st, 2023. Jacobson points out that just will get South Dakota to a consistent 100% wind, water, solar every season, 24/7, 365, except leap year when it's 366. That means that there is no need for any more fossil fuel. Plus, the real bottom line, South Dakota had the ninth lowest energy price in the United States. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, September 3rd, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way to never miss out on a single episode. And we make it a snap for you to accomplish. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, look for the yellow opt-in box, though you really can't miss it, put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one, just one, email with a link to that week's program. And or if you are voracious, you can go to your favorite podcast. We like audience participation here. So if you see something, if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email with that information to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Please, not Facebook. Those tend to get lost in the shuffle. And what you have to say is important to us. And remember, I've got a birthday coming up, so if you want to celebrate by going to Nuclear Hot Seat and donating, we really need your help. Consider it in honor of my landmark cornerstone birthday coming up at the end of this month. Anything helps, and we will really appreciate you for your help. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Hartestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, names of guests whose comments you use, and me. Just give credit where it's due. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, nuclear kills two ways, fast by blast, slow by glow, that glow being exposure to radiation. Over time, it can cause cancer, immune system diseases, birth defects, and infertility. So let's stop making any more radioactive waste until we can find a way to safely store it and get rid of it. There you have it. your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Thanks for being here, and whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we're all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.